Thank you for joining us today, August 16th, 2019, for Creditors' Rights In-Depth Podcast provided by the National Creditors Bar Association. Today's topic, the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals decision regarding Beth Lavallee versus MedOne Solutions. I'm Robin Cole, Acting Executive Director and moderator for today's podcast. Joining us today are Nicole M. Strickler and Stephanie Strickler, both of Messer Strickler Limited, located in Chicago, Illinois. Nicole Strickler concentrates her practice on the defense of consumer financial services litigation throughout the country. This includes representing clients in both individual and class actions involving federal consumer laws, including the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act, Fair Credit Reporting Act, Telephone Consumer Protection Act, Electronic Funds Transfer Act, and related state laws. She also has significant experience dealing with federal and state regulators. Her clients include corporations, lending institutions, collection agencies, asset purchasers, attorneys, as well as individuals. She is a frequent author and speaker on issues affecting the credit and collection industry and currently serves on the NCBA Board of Directors. Stephanie Strickler joined Messer Strickler Limited as an associate in 2013. She is a graduate of the University of Dayton School of Law, where she was a staff writer and comment editor for the University of Dayton Law Review. She concentrates her practice in business litigation, breach of contract, employment law, and consumer defense litigation. Ms. Strickler has defended lawsuits involving state and federal consumer laws, including the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act, the Fair Credit Reporting Act, the Telephone Consumer Protection Act, and the Illinois Collection Agency Act. Nicole and Stephanie, welcome, and thank you for taking the time to update us on the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals decision regarding Beth Lavallee versus MedOne Solutions. Can you give us a summation to start us off on what occurred in this particular case?
Thanks, Robin. We're really excited to be here. This decision has been one that I know a lot of practitioners have been anxiously awaiting the results of. It was a case that I believe was filed in 2015, actually, and was argued in 2018 and has just been decided. So why this decision was so anxiously awaited, so to speak, is that it dealt with an email communication from a debt collector to a consumer. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of us out there were trying, have been asked or attempted in our own practices to try to figure out how to email consumers within the regulations that, you know, apply to us in the credit and collection industry. So
sure,
the facts here are pretty straightforward. So this dealt with two medical deaths that were incurred to a hospital that were referred to debt collector MedOne for collection. Mm-hmm. And MedOne sent an email to Lavallee as what it intended to be, its initial communication.
Okay.
So the emails themselves were pretty generic, and actually if you look at the court opinion, they've screenshotted them in there, which is kind of nice to be able to look back to. Mm. And the email stated, MedOne Solutions has sent you a secure message, and they had an embedded hyperlink, which invited the consumer to basically view a secure package. So in the text of the original email, there's really nothing in there that indicates what the, you know, message is about. It just says it's a secure message, you've received a secure package, you know, click on this link, so to speak, and you'll get more information. So, interestingly, Lavallee, while the emails were never returned as undeliverable, she never clicked on the hyperlink. And nowadays, which is always a little creepy to me, we're able to tell who opens email and if the links are actually clicked on.
Right,
now,
right.
Right? Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
If she had clicked on the link, she would have seen the 1692G validation notice and you know, other information that's required under 1692G, but she didn't. So what ended up happening here is Lavallee had a subsequent or a communication later with MedOne in which she learned about these deaths.
Hmm.
And MedOne did not send another 1692G notice. So it was basically relying on these initial emails to meet its obligations under 1692G. So the consumer argued that the 1692G notice as a result of the email was insufficient under the Act. And the parties, you know, argued about that for some time. The district court ruled in favor of the consumer, finding that MedOne had failed to give the 1692G notice, mm-hmm. and it went up on appeal. So this actually was a case where the CFPB submitted an amicus brief. Those of you listening that don't know what an amicus brief is, it's basically a friend of the court brief where an outside third party that has some type of interest in the litigation submits a brief either for or against one of the parties. And they argued that the matter was actually covered by e-sign, which is something that was never argued in the district court. So, Stephanie, do you want to explain what e-sign is?
I will have you do that.
Okay. Essentially, e-sign is an act that allows certain disclosures that are supposed to be made in writing to be done in an electronic form, right? And it requires certain consents and disclosures that have to be given to the consumer prior to obtaining consent, and applies when a statute or regulation requires that information be provided or made available to a consumer in writing. So they argued that the initial communications didn't satisfy the written notice requirement under 1692JA because MedOne didn't satisfy the conditions of e-sign. So a lot of my, you know, co-defense counsel practitioners and I had been discussing this because it wasn't something that was ever raised in the district court and kind of it was an interesting take on the whole thing. Ultimately, I think I don't agree with that perspective here because I think the Bureau should have realized basically that the disclosures did not have to be made in writing, and so I don't think that it applies if the initial communication is not considered to be a writing, or it's not required to be in writing, because it really isn't. You could technically give it orally, right? So that was a little interesting twist. But ultimately, which is kind of funny, the Seventh Circuit didn't even address it. They said something to the effect of, we don't usually consider arguments made by made in amicus briefs that aren't raised in the district court, and we're not going to do that in this particular case. So they basically said, we don't care what you think, CFPB, which I thought was kind of an interesting take on the whole thing. So what did the court decide, Steph?
The court decided that the emails were not communications. They agreed with the district court, found for the consumer, and basically they said that the emails did not convey any information regarding the debt, and therefore they weren't even communications under the Act, which I think is interesting.
So,
and go ahead.
Oh, no, I was going to say, me too. I think this has a lot of broader implications about communications, right? I mean, if you think about it, really, when we started making arguments about what or what is not a communication under the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act, it was in the context of phone calls, right, and voice messages. Really, I mean, what the defense bar argued for many years was that, you know, simple voice messages that basically gave the name of the person calling and said it was about an important business matter did not constitute communications under the Act and thus were not actionable because it had to be a communication in order to be actionable.
Right.
Well, and then we lost that argument everywhere. I mean, well, not everywhere, but most places after the FODI decision. And then there was a scourge of lawsuits about debt collectors who were leaving the generic, you know, voice message that didn't convey that they were debt collectors in the message. And the reason why they were doing that was to avoid third-party disclosure problems. They were worried someone would overhear the message. Hmm. They would, you know, it would be about, they would assume it'd be about a debt, and then they'd get in trouble. So instead, they would leave as little information as possible and then got sued for the reverse. And we fought those cases for years. I mean, I can't even tell you how many of those cases I had. But now, this decision, at least in the Seventh Circuit, kind of makes me think that it would have rejected that whole analysis. Because all that's really said in this email is MedOne Solutions has sent you a secure message, and you receive a secure package from MedOne Solutions. There's an important message. Basically, click on this to get more information. Well, I think in a comparison, you could say maybe voicemails are more back on the table as they used to be.
Mm. Okay. So the decision does have an effect on the use of other communication methods.
I think so, too. I mean, I think not only voicemails or emails, but also text messages.
Mm.
You know, putting aside the TCPA concerns you have with text messages, which could be an entire other podcast, Robin. It really could.
Okay, duly noted.
But the MedOne, I mean, I think the decision here definitely could be taken and utilized for other types of communications and cases. The other important thing about this decision is it talked about the Casillas case as well that had recently come down about standing. So those of you practitioners out there, so to speak, that are always looking for new defense arguments to be made, I can basically give you a couple facts on the Casillas case. And that, again, was a Seventh Circuit case where the court found that an inadequate 1692G validation notice did not convey standing to the consumer. So in that case, the consumer received the debt collection notice. It had some 1692GA language, but didn't specify that the disputes needed to be in writing in order to trigger certain protections. And the court said, dismissed the case, finding that there was no injury in fact, which is required under Article 3 of the Constitution. So that raised a good question for this case, too, which was, okay, you know, again, we're dealing with 1692GA, right? Does the consumer have standing? And in this particular case, they said there was standing. While in Casillas, they said there was not. And the court talked about two different distinguishing factors, right? The first, instead of it being an inadequate notice, it was a non-existent notice, which the court found to be important. Which I think, Steph, what do you think about that? Where do you draw the line, right?
I know.
Being inadequate?
I think it's difficult. Where do you draw the line? And I also, I mean, the reasoning they had that she would have actually exercised her rights, I think that's a stretch as well. I mean, who's to say that Casillas wouldn't have exercised her rights? They didn't think she would.
I thought that was an interesting assumption, too. I mean, in Casillas, part of the reason why they ruled there was no standing is because she had no dispute relative to the debt. But here, she was this particular plaintiff was a defendant in a collection action at the time of the allegedly non-existent notice. And so they felt like that made a difference. But I don't know that you can really make that assumption without the record, right?
Right.
I mean, I feel like it's kind of a stretch. I personally think there's going to be a lot more case law on these types of scenarios and standing. I know I'm using it in quite a few cases right now. I think others should too, because I think it's a good opportunity. But so ultimately, I mean, the case is really interesting because of this standing opinion on standing and the comparison to the Casillas case, and then obviously on these types of limited content messages.
I think it's interesting that I think it does open the door for more communications, but I also wonder where you draw the line with, I guess, the facts as well. For instance, in this case, MedOne Solutions, they said that there was no conveying of a debt. But what about these collectors that have, you know, like debt recovery in their name or something related to an account or asset or whatever? I think we would have a different result.
I think so, too. I mean, I've definitely defended cases where it's been alleged that the debt collector failed to convey their status as a debt collector and argued just by virtue of their name alone, which had, like, collection services or something like that, that the consumer would have known that they're a debt collector. And I've won on that argument. So I agree. I think if MedOne Solutions' name had been something a little more collectory, is that a word? It is now.
It is now.
Then I think you might have a different argument. So, but this also begs a different question, right, which is the use of hyperlinks in email. So those collectors out there that are using those types of hyperlinks, you know, should you keep doing that? I say no, not a good idea. I mean, and I do feel for MedOne in this case because I think they were really trying to do the right thing by having those hyperlinks and extra assurances that, you know, somebody that wasn't the consumer wouldn't get the email and be able to, like, log in and see someone's personal financial information.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And probably that's maybe even medical information here with this case.
Mm. Oh, for sure. Yeah, and then, you know, obviously you get into HIPAA, right? And I'm sure they had HIPAA concerns, you know, with the fact that it was a hospital bed. But, you know, with HIPAA, there's no private right of action, number one, as to HIPAA. So it's kind of a, you know, obviously I'm not saying no one should comply with HIPAA, but if you're trying to compare the two risk-wise, I would probably say you'd be more concerned with the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act than anything else.
So let me ask you this. Do you see this decision as a positive or a negative for the collection industry overall?
I would say a positive. I mean, I think that we basically got a decision out there that says a limited content message is not a communication at the appellate level. And I think there's a lot of opportunity to extend that in other areas that, like we've discussed. So I think ultimately, although MedOne lost, which again, I feel for them, I feel like they were really trying to do the right thing in this case. Mm-hmm. You know, what the result was a big positive. You know, kind of reminds me of the case in the Seventh Circuit, which now is escaping me, where the Seventh Circuit decided materiality, that misrepresentations had to be material. The defendants also ultimately lost that particular decision. I think that was Ruth versus Triumph Partners. But it led to a really great decision that we were able to use in the future to defend, and I think this is similar.
I would agree
with
that,
yeah. What do you think, Steph?
I would agree. I mean, there's always going to be issues with communications, and I think that it's going to be not necessarily, well, I guess kind of a gray area with how courts are going to rule. But I guess, so you were saying that you would not suggest a hyperlink in emails, and I guess the other, what about text messages? And obviously you can't include, you know, so much information in a text message, so I can see where the hyperlink would be beneficial. Can you even tell if somebody opens a hyperlink when you send a text?
I don't know. That's a good question. I would think that the software companies would have some way of knowing. I think it's related to, like, the IP address, right?
Right,
correct. At least when I've had cases where I've had to argue that consumers have consented to stuff, like, usually what we do is we go back to the IP address, search it, and figure out where the consumer was when that happened, which is usually their house, which then makes it hard for them to argue they weren't the ones that opened the account, but I digress. So But I think, Steph, your point on, like, can you include everything in the text of a text message? You can't, right? Because there's character limitations.
And it's, I mean, so many people communicate via text now, you know?
Yeah, sure.
And who
knows they've like done studies on
what technology will be here in the next 5 to 10 years, you know?
Oh, good point. Maybe we'll all be holograms by then.
Or mind readers. That would be frightening, right?
Very.
Yep.
So changing lanes a little bit, based on the proposed rules, if they were in place, do you see the decision being any different?
I would say maybe. So interestingly enough, the CFPB in the proposed rules really embraces limited content message, right?
Okay.
So I think the CFPB is on board with limited content message, not constituting a communication. Now, whether or not Med 1 had everything in there that the CFPB wanted to be in there, probably not. You also have the issue that, you know, the proposed rules are really strong on e-sign, right? The CFPB, you know, really wants everyone to comply with e-sign. And while there is an exception for your initial communication, if the prior creditor or collector had received e-sign, I think you probably would have an e-sign issue here. But, you know, in terms of, like, whether or not the proposed rules will really be implemented as they are now, it's a big question that's up in the air, right? Realistically, since the comment period has been extended, mm-hmm. we're looking at minimum, I think, another 18 months before anything would have been put into place. And by that time, you know, who knows who will be in charge. So
right.
It's hard to say.
True. Stephanie, anything to add?
No. I think that it's kind of hard to say. I mean, if we're looking 18
sure.
months out, I agree, we could have a completely different administration, and this might not even, you know, be a factor.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, anything else to add?
No, I mean, I just think in conclusion, I mean, it's a important decision. I think defense practitioners out there should take a look. I think, you know, collection attorneys out there should need to take a look if their office is communicating by email. I mean, it's definitely an important decision, and there's lots of good tidbits in there to explore. But that's just the nerdy me. So, you know.
All right. Well, I thank you both, Nicole and Stephanie, for an incredibly informative podcast. Very much appreciated. To our listeners, thank you for joining us. And if you're interested in finding out more about the National Creditors Bar Association, please visit our website at creditorsbar.org. Thanks again, Nicole and Stephanie.
Thank you.
Thanks.